This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Hello, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome. This has become... Thank you. This is just beginning stuff, because I promised Walt that he would get the first and the last words of the evening. And so don't count this, okay? All the writers will be signing their books at the end of the reading in the lobby. I want to thank the Lannan Foundation. I want, in particular tonight, to thank Christy Mesueras Davis, who, despite great personal grief and sadness, made this event happen in a perfect way, as she always does. Walt. Walt Whitman. Walt Whitman, an American, one of the roughs, a cosmos, disorderly, fleshy and sensual, eating, drinking, and breeding. No sentimentalist, no stander above women and men or apart from them. No more modest than immodest. Unscrew the locks from the doors. Unscrew the doors themselves from their jams. Whoever degrades another degrades me. And whatever is done or said returns at last to me. And whatever I do or say, I also return. Through me, the afflatus surging and surging. Through me, the current and index. I speak the password primeval. I give the sign of democracy. By God, I will not accept anything which all cannot have their counterpart of on the same terms. Okay, 1855, Walt Whitman, an unknown, someone who, I guess you could say, tried everything, was a printer, a reporter, poor, came from a family of whom 7 children survived, and of those, 4 died early, often half-witted, mentally ill frequently, alcoholic father. 1855, for no reason that anyone can point to or has ever been able to discover, it's as if he connected to the cosmos and began to write the Song of Myself in notebooks. Notes exist that indicate that. But if any of us were to look at the things that Whitman had published before, we'd have predicted nothing. You know, he wrote this horrible novel. I mean, I know, I read it, called Franklin Evans, or The Inebriate, you know, a novel about, you know, the downfall through alcohol, the sewer, the gutter, the salvation. Terrible book. How does Song of Myself happen? And how does he know? He publishes by himself 750 copies. He sends a copy to his hero, Emerson. Throughout his life, he would write letters to Emerson, beginning, "Dear Master." And he gets a letter back, at the center of which Emerson says, "I greet you at the beginning of a great career." I mean, what a letter. And not only that, Emerson says, "It's very hard for me right now not to just go to New York City." That's where Whitman lived, much of the time in Brooklyn and Camden, New Jersey, but around New York City. And he says, I want to come to New York City to meet the man who answered my call for a great American poet. I can't wait to meet you. And they all couldn't wait. Thoreau came to meet him. It was an astonishing thing. By around a year and a half later, he was publishing a second edition. By his death, There were 9 editions, the very last called the Deathbed Edition, and of Leaves of Grass, his great project that he took his entire life to, writing, arranging, filling in the spaces between poems, more and more poems, each edition redefining him, you know, because he begins, as he says, one of the roughs, you know. This is a guy who had only 5 years of education, all told, you know, and he astonishes us from his first breath, and that's where I want to begin with the idea of breath. I first read Whitman, really read Whitman, because in schools, you know, in the textbooks in schools, in public schools, they're the easy poems. You know, the poems for, in a sense, he didn't think of it this way, but they're for kids. They rhyme. None of the rest of Whitman rhymes. They, you know, are sing-songy. But the real Whitman is erotic and scarily personal. I think he's perhaps the best seducer in all of poetry because he's always talking to you directly. Let me tell you something only I would tell you. I mean, who wouldn't come closer to him? And you feel yourself coming closer. I had gone to the State University of New York at Buffalo in order to be a math major. This was the compromise with my parents who wanted me to be an accountant like they. In my first freshman English American Lit class, they assigned Whitman. I started reading it. Then the lines were so long and my eyes are kind of funny, so I started reading it out loud. And you need big breaths. And as you aspirate Whitman, the oxygen goes to your head, and you start to enter a kind of trance state. And I just started reading him. I walked out of my door and down the hall. I went down to the lobby reading Whitman out loud to where the runaway kids, this was the late 1960s, and university dorm lobbies were full of runaways. Wonderful. I like them so much better than the other people who lived in the dorm. And I'm reading Whitman, and I'm beginning to feel like the Pied Piper, and a bunch of us go into the elevator, and I sit down, and we read Whitman there, read all of Song of Myself for the next 5 hours, you know? And that, by the end of that ride, that was when I knew that I wasn't a math major, but an English major, and that this was all I ever wanted, and I couldn't go on being anything else, because Whitman tells you to be what you are and not to be ashamed of anything, of anything. I mean, he's so brave. You know, it is astonishing. His critics weren't as brave as he. When you read his poems, you know that although he later, you know, he got embarrassed in later life by all the things he came to stand for. So when homosexual poets from England wrote to him about how turned on they were by Calamus, how aroused they were, he wrote back, "Oh, I don't know what to say. I've had 5 children. They're all illegitimate. I've never lived with or married anyone." Even Whitman could not live up to the extraordinary courage of his poems. He speaks for men and women, blacks, Native Americans. There's nothing he doesn't want to put in the poems. We're going to hear that tonight. We have 3 wonderful poets. I'm going to introduce them in order. There won't be introductions in between. And my introductions will be brief because you'll be hearing who they are. We'll be having a conversation after the 3 readings. And I'll tell you, we've been talking Whitman all day. And you're going to have a good time because we've been having a good time. The first is Eamon Grennan, Irish poet, teaches in New York, spends half the year in America, half the year in Ireland. Most recent book, Matter of Fact. second poet, Patty Ann Rogers, magnificent poet. I've known her for many years. The other 2 poets are new friends. Patty Ann's most recent book is called Wayfair. Third poet, absolutely new to me and the cause of many nights of excitement and a call for me to re-examine myself. Major Jackson, he wrote an essay that kind of changed my life, and he has two books, Leaving Saturn and Hoops, and I don't think that there's any more for me to say. Let Walt have it, and here's Eamon Grennan.
Great, Michael. Well, you can really hear that there's at least one person in the house who has been bitten by Whitman. And that was great, Michael. Thanks for laying the ground, really, for what we're going to try to do here. And what we're going to try to do is compose a little collage of Whitman work and read beside Whitman our own work. And I can't speak for the others, but reading my own poem, beside Whitman, is like trying to whistle after the orchestra. We'll read a little bit of Whitman. We won't talk much, probably, about him or about the poems right now, and hold on to that until we have this conversation. There's a seat in the dead middle of the front row here that says reserved. And when I look, I see the spirit of Whitman. I presume it was reserved for Whitman, Christy. So he's there, as he is in what we're trying to channel. I guess we're trying to channel Whitman. And the word is celebration. I mean, we're all enthusiasts. I'm a late convert, if that's the word, although as an ex-Irish Catholic, or an Irish Catholic, there's no such thing as an ex-Irish Catholic. I guess the notion of convert is a curious one. But I didn't, not being American, come to Whitman until quite late, in other words, about 6 months ago, when I inadvertently said, oh, I wish somebody would ask me to do something about Whitman, because I know nothing about him. And 2 weeks later, I had a letter from Christy Missouri Davis saying, Eamon, your wish has been granted. Or don't wish aloud in public places. So anyway, here I am to talk a little bit, but to read primarily from Whitman and a little bit of my own. The first piece I've chosen is a little section from Out of the Cradle, Endlessly Rocking, and I probably chose it because it has Whitman's childhood in it, and it is early in that sense, and it gives a sense in the poem, and I'm only going to read a snatch of it, of how the world, the natural world, birds in this case, came as forms of inspiration for him. Very different from Wordsworth in many ways, but still in a kind of romantic vein, I suppose. And how death is very much part of that, and how love and the erotic are all part of that. And those tend to be the three great leaders of Whitman's imagination in some ways, those things that made him a poet, however the mystery of his coming to be a poet in 1855 was. The poem is kind of like a little aria and recitative, because in the middle he has little bits which he imagines the bird saying. You'll hear them, because I will suddenly go up three octaves. No, I won't, clearly. Out of the cradle, endlessly rocking, out of the mockingbird's throat, the musical shuttle, out of the ninth month midnight, over the sterile sands and the fields beyond, where the child leaving his bed wandered alone, bareheaded, barefoot, down from the Howard halo, down from the mystic play of shadows twining and twisting as if they were alive, out from the patches of briars and blackberries, from the memories of the bird that chanted to me. I, chanter of pains and joys, uniter of here and hereafter, taking all hints to use them, but swiftly leaping beyond them, a reminiscence, sing. Once Pomonok, that's Long Island, by the way, once Pomonok, when the lilac scent was in the air and fifth-month grass was growing up this seashore and some briars, two feathered guests from Alabama, two together, and their nest and four light green eggs spotted with brown, and every day the he-bird to and fro near at hand, and every day the she-bird crouched on her nest silent with bright eyes, and every day I, a curious boy, never too close, never disturbing them, cautiously peering, absorbing, translating, shine, shine, shine. Pour down your warmth, great sun, while we bask, we two, together. Two together. Winds blow south or winds blow north. Day come white or day, night come black. Home or rivers and mountains from home. Singing all time, minding no time, while we two keep together. Till of a sudden, maybe killed, unknown to her mate, one forenoon the she-bird crouched not on the nest, nor returned that afternoon, nor the next, nor ever appeared again. And thenceforward all summer in the sound of the sea, and at night under the full of the moon in calmer weather, over the hoarse surging of the sea, or flitting from briar to briar by day, I heard at intervals the remaining one, the he-bird, the solitary guest from Alabama. Blow, blow, blow. Blow up sea winds along Pomonok's shore. I wait, and I wait, till you blow my mate to me. Yes, when the stars glistened all night long on the prong of a moss-scalloped stake, down almost amid the slapping waves sat the lone singer, wonderful causing tears. He called on his mate. He poured forth the meanings, which I, of all men, know. So that's that. You read the rest for yourselves. Because if that's this is a poem from later on, sometime in the 60s. He published this in a second edition of our third edition, maybe, of Leaves of Grass, which was a text that kept growing and growing and growing, possibly just to take in the largesse of his own spirit, but also the grandeur of the world he knew, which extended from the grass under his feet to the stars in the sky. And this poem called Spontaneous Me, and I regard it, although it was written earlier than the poems of Calamus, as a kind of coming out of Whitman. It's a very sexy poem. It's homoerotic in many ways, but it's erotic in its way. I read bits of it. Because it's quite long, and it is, in fact, a poem of gay love. But it's more than that, because that is only an element in the larger affirmation, which is really the holiness of the body and of sex. Spontaneous me. Spontaneous me, nature, the loving day, the mounting sun, the friend I am happy with, the arm of my friend hanging idly over my shoulder, the hillside whitened with blossoms of the mountain ash, the same late in autumn, the hues of red, yellow, drab, purple, and light and dark green, the rich coverlet of the grass, animals and birds, the private untrimmed bank, the primitive apples, the pebble stones, beautiful, dripping fragments, the negligent list of one after another as I happen to call them to me or think of them, the real poems, what we call poems being merely pictures, the poems of the privacy of the night and of men like me, this poem drooping shy and unseen that I always carry and that all men carry. No, once for all avowed on purpose, wherever are men like me, are our lusty, lurking, masculine poems. Love thoughts, love juice, love odor, love yielding, love climbers and the climbing sap. Arms and hands of love, lips of love, phallic thumb of love, breasts of love, bellies pressed and glued together with love. Earth of chaste love, life that is only life after love. The body of my love, the body of the woman I love, the body of the man, the body of the earth. Soft forenoon airs that blow from the southwest. The hairy wild bee that murmurs and hankers up and down, that gripes the full-grown lady flower, curves upon her with amorous, firm legs, takes his will of her and holds himself tremulous and tight till he is satisfied. The wet of woods through the early hours. Two sleepers at night lying close together as they sleep. One with an arm slanting down across and below the waist of the other. The smell of apples. Aromas from crushed sage plant, mint, birch bark. The boy's longings, the glow and pressure as he confides to me what he is dreaming. The dead leaf whirling its spiral whirl and falling still and content to the ground. The no-form stings that sights, people, objects sting me with. The hubbed sting of myself stinging me as much as it ever can anyone. The souse upon me of my lover, the sea, as I lie willing and naked. The merriment of the twin babes that crawl over the grass in the sun, the mother never turning her vigilant eyes from them, the walnut trunk, the walnut husks, and the ripening or ripened long round walnuts, the continents of vegetables, birds, animals, the consequent meanness of me, should I skulk or find myself indecent, while birds and animals never once skulk or find themselves indecent. There he goes. I've chosen another piece. During the war, Whitman, and this is something absolutely crucial, went down to the battlefields and worked in Washington as a nurse among the wounded. Thousands and thousands and thousands of wounded, not only Northerners but Southerners. He nursed. He brought them apples. He brought them ice cream. He read the paper to them. He brought them tobacco. He gave them little bits of money. He wrote letters for them. They were dying in front of him, all these young men. You heard the last poem. All these young, beautiful, young American bodies were dying. Whitman finally could lodge the ideals of Song of Myself and of a poem like the one I just read into the real world. Here he was among the Americans. Here he was among the males that were killing one another, just brutally walking up and killing one another. And he had to nurse their injured bodies, basically. It's an extraordinary account, and he gives an extraordinary account of it in something called Memoranda from the War, which is a small book, really an account of his notebook jottings from that time. So they have this kind of wonderful immediacy. And I just read one, and interestingly enough, it is, well, I've chosen it because it is, it's about a young Irishman who came over to fight, as many Irish people did, either on the Union side, as in this case, or sometimes on the federal side, on the southern side. June 18th, 1863, it's prose. In one of the hospitals I find Thomas Haley, Company M, 4th New York Cavalry, a regular Irish boy, a fine specimen of youthful physical manliness, shot through the lungs, inevitably dying, came over to this country from Ireland to enlist, has not a single friend or acquaintance here, is sleeping soundly at this moment, but it is the sleep of death, has a bullet hole straight through the lung. I saw Tom when first brought here 3 days since and didn't suppose he could live 12 hours, yet he looks well enough in the face to a casual observer. He lies there with his frame exposed above the waist, all naked for coolness, a fine-built man, the tan not yet bleached from his cheeks and neck. It is useless to talk to him as with his sad hurt and the stimulants they give him and the utter strangeness of every object, face, furniture. The poor fellow, even when awake, is like some frightened, shy animal. Much of the time he sleeps or half sleeps. I often come and sit by him in perfect silence. He will breathe for 10 minutes as softly and evenly as a young babe asleep. Poor youth, so handsome, athletic, with profuse, beautiful, shining hair. One time as I sat looking at him while he lay asleep, he suddenly, without the least start, awakened, opened his eyes, gave me a long, steady look, turning his face very slightly to gaze easier. One long, clear, silent look, a slight sigh, and then turned back and went into his doze again. Little he knew, poor, death-stricken boy, the heart of the stranger that hovered near.
Okay.
You can hear in that, of course, the sheer humanity of the man, as well as you could hear in the other work I read, the sheer versatility and breadth of the poet. Breath and breadth, indeed. And now for something entirely different. Me. So I'll read one poem. But it's not a long poem, but it is a sort of little epic about, you know, by the way, we're here for 9 hours. What time is it? Because the doors have been locked and we said, Whitman, hour and a half, you must be joking. Okay, so anyway, I'll try and get you out before midnight. This is a poem which is about an encounter I had in the country. This country, actually, up in New Hampshire, with a firefly. And it's called, with blinding originality, Firefly. On my last night in the country, a firefly gets stuck in the mesh of the window screen and hangs there, revealing to me its tiny legs, head like a minuscule metal bolt, the beige sack jutting under its curl of a tail, splayed on the fine wire and at intervals sparking, the sack flashing lime green, liquid, electric, on, off, on, again, on, off, on, then stop, as if signaling me in silence, the trapped thing singing its own song. For a while I watched it singing its own song, and then, when it went dark for a long time, I leaned up close to the wire to become a huge looming thing in its eyes and blew on it, gently, the way you'd blow a faint spark to fire again, catching a dead leaf, a dry twig, growing towards flame, and it started to flush, lime green again, on off again, deliberate and slow, a brilliance beyond description which filled my eyes as if responding to the bare encouragement of breath I'd offered, this kiss of life in a lighter dispensation, as if I'd been part of its other world for a minute, almost an element of air, and speaking some common tongue to it, a body language rarefied beyond the vast difference between our two bodies, both of us simply living in this space and making our own sense of it, and almost one another. It's how they talk what we call love to one another, over great distances, making their separate presences felt in the dark, claiming whatever the abrupt compulsions of the blood have brought home to them, then seeking each other out through the blind static that clogs up the night, the mob of small voices and hungry mouths coming between them, that grid of difficulty they have to deal with if they want in every sense to find themselves and to code in their own limbs the complicated burden of this cold light they've been their whole excited lives carrying. Of course, I don't understand their whole lives carrying this cold light that might once have been a figure for the soul at risk, worn on the sleeve, its happenstance of chance and circumstance and will, those habits of negotiation between its own intermittent radiance and the larger dark. Of course, the words I reach to touch it with are clumsy and impertinent, nothing to the real purpose. And of course, it leads its subtle, specific life beyond such blunderings. But it was the smallest of all those creatures I've come close to, looked, however, dumbly into, and was still signaling that last time I breathed its liquid fire to life, blew my own breath into its brief body, and it fell from the wire like a firework spending itself in blackness, one luminous blip of silence into the surrounding night, the way a firework goes, suddenly silent at its height and drifts back down in a dead hush, blobs of slow light growing fainter as they fall into the flattened arms of the dark. But for those moments it inhabited the dark, wired border zone between us. It seemed as if it could be looking back at me, making between my breath and its uncanny light a kind of contact, almost, I want to think, communication, short, entirely circumscribed, and set in true perspective by the static, riddled, big pitch dark, but still something like the way we might telegraph our own selves in short, bright, telling phrases to each other, on, off, on, then stop, the whole live, busy night, a huge ear harking to the high notes of our specific music and to the silence that contains it as the dark contains the light. Thank you.
Well, good evening. Glad that all of you are here, and I'm happy to be here again and happy to be part of this celebration of Whitman's work. I always, when there are three poets reading and two of them are men, I always get to be in the middle. So I used to say it was the two big cheeses and I was the bologna in the middle. Or opposite of that. I was really happy to be asked to do this and to read Whitman and to read something of my own that I thought might have a slight connection to the piece I'd chosen for to read of Whitman's. But I found that was much more difficult task than I thought it was going to be. And so I have all kinds of sticky notes and paper clips and little pieces of paper, and I changed my mind about 100 times about what I was going to read of his and what I would read of mine, but anyway, here we are. You know, there's a saying that You can find, you can get lost in a good book, but you can find yourself in poetry. And I think that's especially true of Whitman, because I will guarantee you everybody here can find him or herself in Whitman. And I don't mean just recognize something, a situation or something. I mean you will find yourself named in here. So everybody, because that's how inclusive Whitman is, not only with people, but with the life of the earth. You're going to find everything there, and also the stars and the night, which he writes about often. It was a special passion of his, going out at night. And so I'm going to read, the first poem is called, or it's not called, it's the 20, part 21 of Song of Myself. I am the poet of the body, and I am the poet of the soul. The pleasures of heaven are with me, and the pains of hell are with me. The first I graft and increase upon myself. The latter I translate into a new tongue. I am the poet of the woman, the same as the man. And I say it is as great to be a woman as to be a man. And I say there is nothing greater than the mother of men. Thank you, Walt Whitman. I chant the chant of delation or pride. We have had ducking and deprecating about enough. I know that size is only development. Have you outstripped the rest? Are you the president? It is a trifle. They will more than arrive there, everyone, and still pass on. It alone is without... I am he that walks with the tender and growing night. I call to the earth and sea, half held by the night. Press close, bare bosomed night. Press close, magnetic, nourishing night. Night of south winds. Night of the large few stars. Still nodding night. Mad, naked summer night. Smile, O voluptuous, cool breathed earth. Earth of the slumbering and liquid trees, earth of departed sunset, earth of the mountains misty topped, earth of the vitreous pour of the full moon just tinged with blue, earth of shine and dark mottling the tide of the river, earth of the lipid gray of clouds brighter and clearer for my sake, far swooping elbowed earth, rich, apple-blossomed earth, smile, for your lover comes. Prodigal, you have given me love, therefore I to you give love. Oh, unspeakable, passionate love. I don't know how many of you knew that Van Gogh was influenced by Walt Whitman's work. And it influenced, in specifically, his painting, Starry Night. They have letters that Van Gogh wrote to his sister and to his brother, praising Whitman's work, urging them to read it. And he was at the very same time writing those letters, he was painting Starry Night. And these lines that I just read were particularly, evidently, very important to Van Gogh in painting that picture. So I think, well, how wonderful for a poet, and for Van Gogh, of course, but for a poet to have, a painter to have painted and been inspired by a poem to paint maybe the most famous and well-known artwork of the Impressionist period. And remember that Whitman has a long section of poems called From Noon to Starry Night. So even the title. So I'm going to read a poem of my own now that I think has something, a connection with Whitman. Because Whitman, as I just read this long list of earth, earth of the slumbering, earth of departed sunset, earth of vitreous pour of the full moon, you know, that repetition is a rhythm and a song of its own. And Whitman does that kind of repetition of lists so well. And it just gets better and better. And I once had somebody tell me that it doesn't matter what you list, it always turns out to be a celebration of some sort. I don't know if that's true. I don't think a grocery store list has to mention. But anyway, the title, and this also has something to do with the earth, as the poem I just read by Whitman does. In addition to faith, hope, and charity, I'm sure there's a God in favor of drums. Consider their pervasiveness, the thump, thump, and slide of waves on a stretched hide of beach. The rising beat and slap of their crests against shore baffles. The rapping of otters cracking mollusks with stones. Woodpeckers beak banging. The beaver's whack of his tail paddle. The ape playing the bam of his own chest. The million tickering rolls of rain off the flat leaves and razor rims of the forest. And we know the noise of our own inventions. Snare and kettle. Bongo, conga, big bass, toy tin, timbals, tambourine, tom-tom. But the heart must be the most pervasive drum of all. Imagine hearing all together every tinny snare of every heartbeat in every jumping mouse and harvest mouse, sagebrush foal and least shrew living across the prairie. And add to that cacophony the individual staccato tickings inside all gnatcatchers, kingbirds, kestrels, rock doves, pine warblers, crossing, crisscrossing each other in the sky, the sound of their beatings overlapping with the singular hammerings of the hearts of cougar, coyote, weasel, badger, pronghorn, the ponderous bass of the black bear, and on deserts too, all the knackings, the flutterings inside wart snakes, whip tails, racers, and sidewinders, earless lizards, cactus owls, plus the clamors undersea, slow booming in the breasts of beluga and bowhead, uniform wrappings in a passing school of cod or bib, the thitterings of bat rays and needlefish. Imagine the earth carrying this continuous din, this multifarious festival of pulsing thuds, stutters, and drummings wheeling on and on across the universe. This must be proof of a power existing somewhere, definitely in favor of such a racket. I just think about that, you know, and I pick up my cat and I can feel the little heart going da 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 da. I think about that. And then I think about the, even in our solar system, which is just a grain of nothing inside this universe that we know a little bit about, not one single, not even a bacteria yet. And here we are on this earth that's just bursting with all kinds of life and hearts beating. Okay. Now, the next poem that I chose to read by Whitman is one in which he presents his vision of sleepers, people sleeping. And I think he feels there's something transformative about sleep. And I've had that thought myself, that, and so maybe you have too. I don't know. You know, they always say, oh, he's such an angel when he's asleep, you know. So, I mean, someone might have said that about Hitler. I don't know. You know, there's just some kind of a transformation that happens during that strange state of sleeping or watching someone else who is there but not there. Okay. So this is part of the leaves of grass, and I'm going to read this this poem. It's hard to call anything by Whitman a poem, because all of this whole book is bound together in poetic writing. So anyway, here's a portion of this. The sleepers are very beautiful as they lie unclothed. They flow hand in hand over the whole earth from east to west as they lie unclothed. The Asiatic and African are hand in hand. The European and American are hand in hand. Learned and unlearned are hand in hand. And male and female are hand in hand. The bare arm of the girl crosses the bare breast of her lover. They press close without lust. His lips press her neck. The father holds his grown or ungrown son in his arms with measureless love. And the son holds the father in his arms with measureless love. The white hair of the mother shines on the white wrist of the daughter. The breath of the boy goes with the breath of the man. Friend is enarmed by friend. The scholar kisses the teacher, and the teacher kisses the scholar. The wronged is made right. The call of the slave is one with the master's call, and the master salutes the slave. The felon steps forth from the prison. The insane becomes sane. The suffering of sick persons is relieved. The sweatings and fevers stop. The throat that was unsound is sound. The lungs of the consumptive are resumed. The poor, distressed head is free. The joints of the rheumatic move as smoothly as ever and smoother than ever. Stiflings and passages open. The paralyzed become supple. The swelled and convulsed and congested awake to themselves in condition. They pass the invigoration of the night and the chemistry of the night and awake. I too pass from the night. I stay a while away, O night, but I return to you again and love you. I have a really sexy poem called When at Night, but I'm not going to read it. You have to buy a book if you want to read it. Right. Oops. I knew I was going to lose all these papers and things, and it happened to me once, actually more than once. That was the night that I hit my water glass and it went flying across the stage. And I went and picked it up, and it was a glass like this, which is not glass, it's plastic. And I brought it back and I poured it full again from the pitcher. But, you know what, I'd probably guess what happened. It had cracked. So then I picked it up to take a drink, not knowing, and the whole table, was flooded, and it was terrible. So I'm very careful with. Well, what I'm going to read, because that was a poem of Whitman's called "The Sleepers," I'm going to read when you watch us sleeping. And, all of us, I say all of us, I mean that, I don't know where, it's hard to attribute a poem that I have written to someone else. to what Whitman wrote here, which I think did have a place in it, but not, I didn't know it at the time, you know, but we're full of poems by other people, and so we're bound to be influenced, and so maybe, I don't know what connection this has with Whitman, except it's my poem about sleepers. When you watch us sleeping, when you see us lying scented in our night clothes, the patchwork quilt wadded at our feet, coverlet kicked aside, when you see us still at midnight, our bare arms covered with the moon shadows of the hemlock by the window, our hands latent and half open on the pillows by our heads. When you come upon any of us buried but breathing, close to the earth, motionless as oak leaves beneath drifts of oak leaves, or curled inside silk body vases hanging from greasewood and vetch, or sprawled languid under the broad branches of the baobab in summer heat, when you hear us humming hoarsely sometimes, scarcely wheezing, murmuring like white hens at their roost, when you watch the green anole on the banyan, cool and slender as a pod, the onyx grain of his eye closed deep in green sunlight, when you can see how he obviously possesses in his body, even in the slack scaly skin of rose beneath his jaw, even in the posing net of his ribs, even in the corpuscle of blood at the tip of his tail, how he possesses in his body alone all the power he needs to rise and declare not merely truth, but rapture. The living body asleep, so great a sum of beauty that a billion zeros follow it. The eyes sealing the head so tightly during those moments that the infinity of possible heavens inside can be clearly perceived by anyone. When you watch us sleeping, when you see the purest architecture of the ear, the explicit faith of the knee, the old, guiltless, unforgiving, adoring, sweet momentary tremble of claim in the breast, aren't you sorry? Don't you love us? Thank you.
To you. Whoever you are, I fear you are walking the walks of dreams. I fear these supposed realities are to melt from under your feet and hands, even now your features, joys, speech, house, trade, manners, troubles, foibles, costume, crimes, dissipate away from you. Your true soul and body appear before me. They stand forth out of affairs, out of commerce, shops, work, farms, clothes, the house, buying, selling, eating, drinking, suffering, dying. Whoever you are, now I place my hand upon you, that you be my palm. I whisper with my lips close to your ear. I have loved many women and men, but I love none better than you. That was the opening to a poem called To You, and like Patty Ann Rogers says, it's very difficult to choose what one is to read in celebrating Whitman. So much is there. It's so voluminous. But I chose work that I thought kind of exemplified the means and the passion by which Whitman affirms and dignifies all that is human, including the body. So that's where most of my selections will come from.
My other choices seem to center around the fact that it's Whitman, along, of course, with Emily Dickinson, who becomes the foundation for much of American poetry, as we learn in school. But he, more than anyone else, gives us the music to our particular lives. There's no longer the need to write our lives in metrical verse. And one thinks with that music, I go into Walmart, of which I'm sure if Whitman were to step foot in, he would lose it, because it's all there before him. Or Home Depot, you know. When one walks into these places, that is Whitman's vision, ironically enough. But he also does more than catalog our lives. He catalogs emotions. And he's sensuous. He's the seducer. He's also argumentative. He contradicts himself, as he says. Here's a little prose section called The Great Unrest of Which We Are Part, of which I could not help but read given the events of the past, glorious events of the past 3 months, The Great Unrest of Which We Are Part. My thoughts went floating on vast and mystic currents as I sat today in solitude and half shade by the creek, returning mainly to two principal centers. One of my cherished themes for a never achieved poem has been the two impetuses of man and the universe. In the latter, creation's incessant unrest, exfoliation, Darwin's evolution, I suppose. Indeed, what is nature but change in all its visible and still more its invisible processes? Or what is humanity in its faith, love, heroism, poetry, even morals, but emotion? Which is something I like to share with my students as we begin to discuss and read poetry, that it's still the art of emotion. This is from Children of Adam. I sing the body electric. What I said earlier about Whitman dignifying human lives, I guess what I meant also is that in the face of chattel slavery, there's this wonderful moment in which a dehumanized man and woman are somehow humanized in Whitman's vision, which is the glorious, one of the great glorious aspects of his work. A man's body at auction. For before the war, I often go to the slave mart and watch the sale. I help the auctioneer. The sloven does not have know his business. Gentlemen, look on this wonder. Whatever the bids of the bidders that cannot be high enough for it, the globe lay preparing quintillions of years without one animal or plant. For it, the revolving cycles truly and steadily rolled. In this head, the all-baffling brain. In it and below it, the makings of heroes. Examine these limbs. Red, black, or white, they are cunning and tendon and nerve. They shall be stripped that you may see them. Exquisite senses, life-lit eyes, pluck, volition, flakes of breast, muscle, pliant, backbone, and neck, flesh not flabby, good-sized arms and legs, and wonders within there yet. Within there runs blood, the same old blood, the same red-running blood. There swells and jets a heart. There are passions, desires, reachings, aspirations. Do you think they are not there because they are not expressed in parlors and lecture rooms? This is not only one man. This the father of those who shall be fathers in their turns. In him, the start of populous states and rich republics. Of him, countless immortal lives with countless embodiments and enjoyments. How do you know who shall come from the offspring of his offspring through the centuries? Who might you find you have come from yourself if you could trace back through the centuries? There was a moment in which I realized after reading this poem of mine for maybe 3 years that I probably owe Mr. Whitman royalty, because I think I stole a line or two, particularly the ending. It's this poem that I was introduced to in high school when I heard The Learned Astronomer, which is a wonderful classroom poem. When I heard The Learned Astronomer, when the proofs, the figures were ranged in columns before me, when I was shown the charts and diagrams to add, divide, and measure them, when I, sitting, heard the astronomer where he lectured with much applause in the lecture room, how soon unaccountable I became, tired and sick, till rising and gliding out, I wandered off by myself in the mystical, moist night air, and from time to time looked up in perfect silence at the stars. And I think there are I have a few poems that end with someone looking up at the stars. This is one of them. And I say that one of the great projects, of course, is Mr. Whitman dignifying the human enterprise and all of us, like Patty Ann Rogers says. But I think that's something that much of American poets have attempted to do, either by mapping their poems or mapping the parts of America, much in the way that Whitman does in his great poem. Here's a poem called How to Listen. I am going to cock my head tonight like a dog in front of McGlinchey's Tavern on Locust. I am going to stand beside the man who works all day combing his thatch of gray hair corkscrewed in every direction. I am going to pay attention to our lives unraveling between the forks of his fine-toothed comb. For once, we won't talk about the end of the world or Vietnam or his exquisite paper shoes. For once, I am going to ignore the profanity and the dancing and the jukebox so I can hear his head crackle beneath the sky stretch of faint stars. One of my lessons from Mr. Whitman was that repetition that he so often uses in his work, but also that long, lush, capacious line. It was something that I particularly paid attention to and wanted to enact in my own work. This is a poem called Mr. Pate's Barbershop. It was written at a time in which, or it recalls a time in which I was growing up, and there were a number of friends of mine who were lost to the drug wars that were happening in major cities, of course, most definitely in Philadelphia. And the barber here, we had this wonderful rumor about him. This is a man who cut my hair from age 2 to about 22. And we had this great rumor that he didn't throw hair away. He just put it in jars and kept it in the back of his shop. Mr. Pate's Barbershop. I remember the room in which he held a blade to my neck and scraped the dark hairs foresting a jawline, stacks of ebonies and jets, clippings of black boxers, Joe Frazier, Jimmy Young, Jack Johnson. The color television bolted to a ceiling like the one I watched all night in the waiting room at St. Joseph's while my cousin recovered from gunshots. I remember the old Coke machine, a water fountain by the door, how I drank the summer of 88 over and over from a paper cone cup and still cannot quench my thirst. But this was the year funeral homes boomed, the year Mr. Pate swept his own shop, for he had lost his best little helper to crossfire. He suffered like most barbers suffered, quietly, his clippers humming so loud he forgot Ali's lightning left jab. His love for angles, for carpentry, for baseball, he forgot everything and would never be the same. I remember the way the blade gleamed fierce in the fading light of dusk, and the reflection of myself panned inside the razor's edge, wondering if I could lay down my pen, close up my ledgers and my journals, if I could undo my tie and take up barbering, where months on end a child's head would darken at my feet and bring with it the uncertainty of tomorrow. Or like Mr. Pate, gathering clumps of fallen hair at the end of a day in short, delicate whisk, as though they were the fine findings of gold dust he'd deposit in a jar and place on a shelf, only to return Saturdays, collecting as an antique dealer collects, growing tired, but never forgetting someone has to cherish these tiny little heads. I sing The Body Electric, Section 8. A woman's body at auction. She, too, is not only herself. She is the teeming mother of mothers. She is the bearer of them that shall grow and be mates to the mothers. Have you ever loved the body of a woman? Have you ever loved the body of a man? Do you not see that these are exactly the same to all in all nations and times all over the earth? If anything is sacred, the human body is sacred, and the glory and sweet of man is the token of manhood untainted, and in man or woman a clean, strong, firm-fibered body is more beautiful than the most beautiful face. Have you seen the fool that corrupted his own live body? Or the fool that corrupted her own live body? For they do not conceal themselves and cannot conceal themselves.
As soon as they remove the podium, we're going to begin our conversation. So let's applaud more while they remove the podium.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
I think they're telling me we can start. I want to begin by saying, I feel incredibly honored to be sitting among three poets and hearing their voices. You know, this skill, this gift, this song, whatever it is something that I never had but only know of. And to be able to be with them on a stage, celebrating a poet that I love too. It really, I mean, I'm sorry. I know that I'm a crier. thank you. It's so moving to me. I hope to you too. I mean, this is what we wanted, a celebration. I want to begin by asking, because I only think impossible questions should be asked, the most impossible one of all. In your experience as young people writing poetry, as teachers teaching people to write poetry, in your dreams of what poets have done, how could it be this thing of a man who no one knows to be a poet, writing this stuff, first crack off the bat? I mean, like, do you all start out having feelings, intimations of inspiration like that? What is it to know, and when do you know that you're a poet? Because it seems like such a miracle in Whitman.
There's a famous poem, I think, by one of the Eastern Europeans, which has a long dialogue about when are you a poet? And he says, when I've just written a poem, then I'm the poet. Then I stop being a poet, and then I wait. Right? And then I'm just me. And I do think, for me anyway, I mean, I don't think there's any general rule in this at all. I think people are stricken from the... I think people move towards being a poet. I think people learn about it in school. People come close to language as a need and as an opening onto the world. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, it seems to me, Whitman is mysterious. I think he's more mysterious than most of the poets we know. Of course, Dickinson is mysterious too. And it's an extraordinary thing to have the two great mysteries as the grandfather and grandmother of American poetry. And no wonder, as a result, that the poetry of the 20th century in English has been dominated by American poets. It's great, aside from Yeats, of course. I don't know if there's any real answer to that, except we'll all have our own little individual answers. For me, it was one of slow growth and movement towards, and then finally feeling, okay, what I'm doing there is probably like a poem. And so I'll try to do it again, basically. That was me, anyway. Patty Ann and Major are different. Sure.
I don't know how to answer that question. It's a big one. I think I didn't call myself a poet for a long, long time. It just seemed too grand a thing to call myself. I think that Whitman didn't just spring up. You know, he had been writing a long time, and he'd been writing evidently in the kind of journalism where you get a lot of criticism. You know, I've taught journalism students. They're easier to teach. They don't have as much pride and stubbornness as somebody who already thinks they're a poet. But because they're used to that red pencil. You know, a journalist is used to that. And so it doesn't, they're not wounded. Whoops.
It's your heart.
Yeah. They're not wounded by you know, a workshop leader in a very polite way saying, you might want to think about that line and change a word or two. Or,
well. We should hold the...
No, I don't think so. You might get wet.
I don't know.
Anyway, he had been writing, you know, and also he was evidently, as I understand it, he wandered around a lot and watched people and listened to them and listened to the rhythm of the language, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. And
opera.
Yes, and opera mm-hmm. was a big influence, and he not only writes about opera mm-hmm. and music, mm-hmm. but that, you know, he obviously absorbed the kind of cadences and rhythms that later were in his work, as well as
the Bible.
The Bible, mm-hmm. uh-huh. mm-hmm. the Bible, and the repetition in the Bible, and so he didn't just spring up out of nothing. And you know, I guess that's enough to say about that. You know, that he found what is so flippantly said, his voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He found his voice. He found the music that allowed him to express this passion mm-hmm. that he had been feeling for evidently a long time and experiencing. Mm-hmm. But you know, he's such a phenomenon because you cannot categorize him. Mm-hmm. You can't categorize him. You can't say he's a nature poet. He's a city poet. Mm-hmm. No, he's not a city poet. He's mm-hmm. a poet of science. Mm-hmm. Although, I won't talk about that. Go ahead.
No, I will not try to answer that question. It's so difficult. But I will say that to a great extent, Whitman is not unlike all of us. He is a mystery, but he's not unlike all of us who hear music or who take walks or who fills a city and its vibrancy. I think he had lived with language and he had mm-hmm. found his particular form by which to express it, and I think that's what we all possibly mm-hmm. share here is this kind of love of music that is embedded in the English language. I mean, that's the other aspect that we don't talk about when we talk about Whitman. Yes, we talk about his capturing and becoming the voice of the manifest destiny that is America, but there's something gorgeous about how he gets inside a language and incants and create these mm-hmm. wonderful litanies so that it becomes this amazing felt experience with language itself outside of the content right. alone. I mean, and it's rhythmic and it's just gorgeous.
Well, he's mouth fixated. Mm-hmm. You know? I mean, he's mm-hmm. voice fixated mm-hmm. and his ears are alive to everything. Mm-hmm. And he works with the antennae of the ear. All the time.
That's right. And I think it's Galway Connell who says, you know, when we talk about poets, we talk about how they have a good ear for language. Mm-hmm. And Galway says Whitman had a great mouth, yeah. and he loved those great those sounds,
chewable sounds.
Yeah.
And you know, he captures the vision of America, and I think that not only the vision of America, but he is a cosmic poet. He sees the earth in a cosmic kind of way, so that his vision is not just America. It's the earth within the universe. It's all, as I was saying in as I began this reading, that you will find yourself in there, mm-hmm. named. Mm-hmm. Your name will be there. But he not only was America's poet, I guess, that he captured the vision of America, but America gave him the space and the sound and the vibrancy and the energy of this new vision of what a nation could be, so that it was a reciprocal gift, mm-hmm. I think.
Yeah, I mean, America gave him a language, really, and it was the language of the modern. Mm-hmm. And what he does is become the voice of the modern, fundamentally. I mean, the modernists kind of scorned Whitman to a certain degree, but in fact, they come out under his overcoat, basically. And there is this grand sense that in Whitman, too, he had the courage to be bad. I mean, as a poet, he had the courage to just expose the self. Mm-hmm. And partly that exposition of the self was a very dangerous thing. I mean, not only in the sexual matters, but he could be silly. You know, I mean, he could just be a litanizer. He could just do things one after the other. But he had the courage of the self. I mean, this is what always amazes me, or at least has recently since I've been trying to read him, is the degree to which he has an extraordinary bravery. I mean, it's his courage that strikes me as most. He's such a. The more you read about Whitman, the more you think he is to be, as a person, a lovable person. Mm-hmm. You know, for all the posing and all, he is still, and the Civil War stuff that he does down in the hospitals confirms that. But it's courage that marks him. And I think that, as a poet, was, you know, I don't know if we all have it. I certainly probably don't, because you're more restrained and all. But he had the courage to just go out there and push himself out on a limb, particularly in the 1855, particularly when he's starting, it's very interesting, about two-thirds of his work was written in about 8 years. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't young, you know, I mean, living from 1819 to 1891 or something like that. Uh-huh. So he lived a fair share. But an enormous amount of that work was written early. Mm-hmm. But he had the courage just to go off the springboard. Mm-hmm. He didn't stand there jugging up and down, wondering, will I dive in? No, off he went into the universe.
I know. Kind of, but see, I think that's part of what America gave him.
Yeah.
Because people were doing that in other ways all around him.
That's
They were coming in from other places across a wild ocean, establishing themselves. Yeah. And there was a sense of possibility, which is still in this country, I think. That things are possible, that those immigrants had not felt was possible.
Mm-hmm. Until in their own home country.
In their own home countries. Yeah. But now they were in a country of possibility. So America was giving Whitman as much as he was giving back.
That's true.
You know, the energy of the country. Mm-hmm. And I was saying today that the landscape of his poems, the openness and the vastness and the promise and the inclusiveness, that is America. That mm-hmm. was the vision of America, I think, that he absorbed. Yeah. And he absorbed that by wandering mm-hmm. around mm-hmm. and just observing mm-hmm. and
being a Geiger counter and being a spectroscopy kind of. He's all the sciences. He's also, it's amazing to the degree to which a great poet needs that collusion or a sort of collision between himself or herself and the surroundings.
Right.
And Yeats, for example, with Ireland, has the same. But he turns out to be such a different poet. And very interestingly, Yeats said early on when he's a young man in the 1880s, he sits down and he's writing in a place near where I lived in Dublin, in fact, and he's writing in a house there, and he says, "We must do for Ireland and literature what Whitman has done for America."
Yeah.
And he saw Whitman. He kind of abandoned Whitman later because he thought America turned against Whitman, which in effect it did.
Yeah.
Whitman
yeah.
wasn't a
yeah.
popular poet.
No.
He was a beloved poet in many respects, but Yeats wanted to be a kind of a national poet, and he said, well, Whitman wasn't a national poet because they turned against him, so he did something else. But nonetheless, it is exactly what Patty Ann says. He is in this collaboration with his own
right.
context
yeah.
in a certain way. Yeah.
I want to turn the conversation in a slightly different direction, a direction that people don't talk about in Whitman, but as you spoke, especially the voice of the modern that you mentioned and the spirit of America, which one thinks of as a very voluble spirit. People talking about I do this, I do that, poems, Frank O'Hara, stuff like that. They all talk about how noisy the poetry gets, and one of the problems of it is that it's always thrusting.
For Whitman's work?
No, of other talky kind of poets. What amazes me about Whitman is he seems to hear silence as well as he hears motion. I remember my teacher, Hugh Kenner, isolated a line that he thought was beautiful in Whitman, and he was far from a Whitman admirer. He quoted, it is only the lull I like, the hum of your valved voice. And boy, what a line. And, you know, Whitman looking at a dung beetle rolling, or all the things he does, the way the poetry allows us to rest and heal from his assaultive voice by also appreciating the tiny and the silent.
I mean, I think that's everywhere. The noiseless patient spider is a kind of little emblem of that, isn't it? His attention. But as you were saying earlier this morning, Major, too, the movement from the grand to the small is perpetual in Whitman. You know, one time he's talking about the stars, and another time he's talking about, you know, a man in a bar. And the sense of his capacity for doing that is his attention, his capacity for paying attention. And I think that's, to go back to the original question, where it all came from. The man kept notebooks, you know? And the notebooks are amazing because they're all these dashes. And if you look and read them, they start to turn into lines. And that's, he has the, what you call, the cadence of the note taker, and it's just that's elaborated in something like the big poems we read. You know?
And it's bodily, enormously bodily. Yeah. That silence does not get in the way of him being cosmopolitan. I mean, that one thinks that silence, particularly in the poem, like when I heard the learned astronomer. To go from the kind of the noise of the astronomer and the charts and then just go out in the silence of the stars and let that be the teacher's equally informative and informed as much as his poems about walking or crossing Brooklyn Ferry. There's something citified about that. Interesting.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, as a poet of the city, for example, he aside from Baudelaire, with Baudelaire is the poet of the city, isn't he?
Yes.
I mean,
you can't categorize him.
You can't.
He's not a nature poet, but he is a nature poet. He's not a city poet, but he is a city poet.
Yeah, he's a wise poet. He's a silly poet.
Yeah, right.
You can say both too, right?
But you know, he does leave spaces, and it's surprising in something that you could call so dense that you can pick out a sentence that is so. A powerful all by itself. You know, he's very quotable as just one sentence. Like urge, always the procreate urge of the earth or the world, you know.
I wanted to ask you, I was reading an essay by a critic named Kenneth Burke, and he suddenly got this idea looking in an index of first lines of Whitman,
that if you just took first lines at Whitman at random, took 20 of them, you'd have a Whitman poem.
Yeah, yeah.
You could, I bet.
Well, he does. I mean, in this essay, he makes a Whitman poem out of the first lines. And I just wondered, that points to sort of an absence of development in the poems. Do you feel that? I mean, how does he manage to get through a poem with so little forward motion?
Well, we...
He doesn't get through. That's the thing. He just keeps going.
Right. It's like Whitman on Whitman. You know, he's like inhaling Whitman juice, you know.
That's what we said about picking out something to read here.
Right.
In 15 minutes, Whitman never stops. You just have to cut it.
But it's interesting to watch also the way those poems are composed and to start to just pay attention to the actual extraordinary dedication to craft. But it's a craft of accumulation. It's a craft of, they call it in grammatical terms, parataxis. It's and. And he resists the Henry James syntax sentence, you know, in which things are subordinated one to the other by the measure of importance, you know. They just are there. And their being there is what Whitman celebrates. And he finds the style to celebrate that as a style of going on and on and on. There is no... And in that sense, his style is a true democracy.
That's so brilliant because... You know, the and, as opposed to grammatical subordination, is what allows him to say and show stylistically that everything is equal.
That's right. Or if it's not equal, it coexists.
Uh-huh.
It's all there. I love the notion that the last play of Shakespeare's was called, it's called one way, it's called Henry VIII, but at the other way, it's called All is True. Mm. And you think, whoa. There's a line to go out on, you know. But in fact, just a tiny anecdote attached to it. At the first production of the same play, the Globe burned down. All right, where the theater in which it was being played is called the Globe, and down came the Globe with All is True. You know, that was the end of Shakespeare. But Whitman has the same kind of absolute affirmative. Mm-hmm. It's the universal. Affirmation of yes, bad stuff, evil stuff, all the kind of stuff we want to categorize and put into, as you're calling it, subordination, as we want to find a syntax for, Whitman finds a parataxis for, you know, a kind of an accumulation. And that is an image of democracy, as it might be called. So in that sense, poetry is the image of democracy, you know, because things aren't subordinated. They are merely allowed into the same space, and they like a big sentence stanza of Whitman, they perform within the space to the full degree of their capacity. I suppose that's
I love
what
that,
we want.
That's beautiful. I wish I had my notebook here. It's stunning.
Well, I guess that's what we saw on the Mall a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it?
Yeah,
2 million people saying yes.
Yeah. I don't remember who it was, but I read an essay in which they compared John Coltrane and Walt Whitman and talked about the solo and talked about particularly Coltrane's long solos. And there's a great story of Coltrane going up to Miles Davis and asking him, how does he know when to end the solo? And Miles tell him, take the darn sax out of your mouth. That's how you know.
Yeah.
Just take it out of your mouth. but that breath, just to go back to that, that kind of breathing and that the improvisation that gets in a tune like My Favorite Things, but also adds to that. I think much in the same way that a musician can play themselves into a mystical zone, just to go back to the note-taking and the composition and dedication to craft, I think Whitman also, as he was writing, really started to feel the pacing and the rhythm and the incantation. Mm-hmm. And I think it really does become not just this kind of off-the-cuff, let me embody all that is America, let me sing myself and sing you. I really do believe that at some point the project takes over.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Takes over him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Self-propelled in that
self-propelled,
sense.
Yeah. The
what he's inaugurated becomes an engine for further generation. So it becomes a very organic thing too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, he found what we say is his voice.
Yeah.
The voice that allowed him to express what he didn't know he wanted to express until he found the voice.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was kind of a wondering person, mm-hmm. and he also had instruction, even though it was only 5 years of formal schooling. You can't write for a magazine and have an editor without without getting a lot of instruction about your writings.
I have to admit, I mean, when I was younger, I thought just so much of Whitman was about posing, you know. Posing, yeah. I love deeper than you. I
That's right.
experience the flowers sort of. More than you.
Yeah. More than you.
More than you, yes.
Yeah.
But there is
like,
always.
You have to like, somehow live
there.
Up to
yeah.
that.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
always running for office.
I mean, look at this.
He's always afraid.
Jeez.
That if he doesn't mention you, you won't vote for him. And what he wants you to elect him as is Whitman in chief. You know, yeah. you know, like the best Whitman of all.
There's two great images in my mind anyway, and there are two visits to Whitman. And the first was very early, just after 1855, when he published his first book, and Thoreau and not Emerson, somebody else came to visit him. In his rather dilapidated apartment, wherever it was in Brooklyn, I suppose, was it? And, you know, it was a midden of books and a litter and papers and pencils and things and sticky. And he was in his pajamas or in his underwear or whatever he was. And he greeted them and we had a good chat. But one of the memories, as the record of this says, there was a chamber pot sticking out from under the bed. Right, so that's great. And so that's one image. But in the 1880s, in other words, 30 years later, when Whitman had become Whitman and become the great, great, the good, great poet, Oscar Wilde visited him.
Yeah.
And I, the very notion of Oscar Wilde and Walt Whitman in the same room is only too charming, as I said, too charming. But
look the other way.
And I think, and Walt asked him to sit on his knee, you know. Big mistake, since Oscar was a very heavy, tall man, which he didn't do, but he did kiss him passionately on the lips as he left, and Whitman savored it forever, as far as I can tell. But the point of the little anecdote, as I remember it, is that when Oscar, a master of the stage set, one can only assume, Oscar Wilde was, came into the Whitman apartment, it was very spare, there was a table. The great, great poet was sitting framed in the window, which shone a positive light on his halo of gray hair. And you could see masts, ship masts through the window. And on a table was a Dante, a Shakespeare, a glass of water, a cruse, as they say, a pitcher of water, glass pitcher of water, and a flower, one flower. That was it. So I think to move from the first visit to the second is, you see, the development of a pose, right?
Right, yes, that's right. Says
the least.
But not only that, you know, Thomas Eakins, who came to visit,
painted
him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the great American painter and photographer, and they discussed this together. There are things in Eakins's notebooks about his time with Walt that, you know, setting and pose and framing in particular is very important. Mm-hmm. We all thought, you know, we could do this forever, you know, and I think maybe you can see that you might all like to stay forever, but we thought that we wanted to give you some poetry for the end, you know, to return it to the spirit. And I guess what we're going to do now, because we've all got a zillion lists of what we might do, you know, we'll be reading some Whitman. The poets will read some of their own work if they choose. And I think that, you know, one of the things we'll be doing is talking about the Whitman we didn't get to talk about. One of the things that, you know, no one has said, but used to be said most of all,
was that Whitman is a great poet of death, and that the When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloom is not only the great American poem of death, it's one of the greatest of American poems. Harold Bloom, for instance, thinks it underlies all of the structure of The Wasteland, which is odd because Eliot publicly disliked and discarded Eliot Whitman. But so I thought that I would start with one of at least his acknowledgments that death means a lot to him. It's, you know, from the very first, the seventh section of the 1855 Leaves of Grass. I'm going to try and not let the book interpose between the microphone and my eyes, but I'm a, you know, my eyesight is bad. Has anyone supposed it lucky to be born? I hasten to inform him or her it is just as lucky to die, and I know it. I pass death with the dying and birth with a new-washed babe and am not contained between my hat and boots and peruse manifest objects, no two alike and every one good. The earth good and the stars good and their adjuncts all good. I am not an earth nor an adjunct of an earth. I am the mate and companion of people, all just as immortal and fathomless as myself. They do not know how immortal, but I know. Every kind for itself and its own, for me, mine, male and female, for me, all that have been boys and that love women, for me, the man that is proud and feels how it stings to be slighted, for me, the sweetheart and the old maid, for me, mothers and the mothers of mothers, for me, lips that have smiled, eyes that have shed tears, for me, children and the begetters of children. Who need be afraid of the merge? Undrape. You are not guilty to me, nor stale, nor discarded. I see through the broadcloth and gingham, whether or no, and am around, tenacious, acquisitive, tireless, and can never be shaken away.
More of I Sing the Body Electric. Oh, my body, I dare not desert the likes of you and other men and women, nor the likes of the parts of you. I believe the likes of you are to stand or fall with the likes of the soul, and that they are the soul. I believe the likes of you shall stand or fall with my poems, and that they are my poems. Man's, woman's, child's, youth's, wife's, husband's, mother's, father's, young man's, young woman's poems. Head, neck, hair, ears, drop, and tympan of the ears, eyes, eye fringes, iris of the eye, eyebrows in the waking or sleeping of the lids, mouth, tongue, lips, teeth, roof of the mouth, jaws and the jaw hinges, nose, nostrils of the nose and the partition, cheeks, temples, forehead, chin, throat, back of the neck, neck slough, strong shoulders, manly beard, scapula, hind shoulders, and the ample side round of the chest, upper arm, armpit, elbow socket, lower arm, arm sinews, arm bones, wrist and wrist joints, hand, palm, knuckles, thumb, forefinger, finger joints, fingernails, broad breast front, curling hair of the breast, breast bone, breast side, ribs, belly, backbone, joints of the backbone. Hips, hip sockets, hip strength, inward and outward round, man balls, man root, strong set of thighs, well carrying the trunk above, leg, fibers, knee, knee pan, upper leg, lunder leg, ankles, instep, football, toes, toe joints, the heel, all attitudes, all the shapeliness, all the belongings of my or your body or anyone's body, male or female.
just going to read here a few lines that are some of the more famous lines of Whitman's. This is part 31 of Song of Myself. I believe a leaf of grass is no less than the journey work of the stars, and the pismire is equally perfect, and a grain of sand, and the egg of the wren, and the tree toad is a chef d'oeuvre for the highest, and the running blackberry would adorn the parlors of heaven, and the narrowest hinge in my hand puts to scorn all machinery, and the cow munching with depressed head surpasses any statue, and a mouse is miracle enough to stagger sextillions of infidels.
Yeah. I just have a small thing. But what I part of the Whitman that I loved and learned to love in this encounter was the degree to which small poems, little things, are so memorably caught and held and seen. And when he gets quiet, when he doesn't proclaim, when he just sees. And here's a wee poem that actually ends in silence, but it's a different kind of silence. It's not the cosmic silence that he feels in the astronomer poem when he's out under the stars. It's something quite different, and you'll hear. It's called A Glimpse. A glimpse through an interstice caught of a crowd of workmen and drivers in a barroom around the stove late of a winter night, and I, unremarked, seated in a corner. Of a youth who loves me and whom I love, silently approaching and seating himself near that he may hold me by the hand. A long while amid the noises of coming and going, of drinking and oath and smutty jest. There we two, content, happy in being together, speaking little, perhaps not a word. That's it. That's it.
I had promised that Whitman would have the last word tonight, and Whitman always wanted the last word. And like all good savior types, he makes his promise that if you look for him in 5,000 years, you'll still find him. And we decided that we would read a poem together. It's the very last section of Song of Myself, and Patty Ann will begin.
The spotted hawk swoops by and accuses me. He complains of my gab and my loitering.
I, too, am not a bit tamed. I, too, am untranslatable. I sound my barbaric yelp over the roofs of the world.
The last good of day holds back for me. It flings my likeness after the rest and true as any on the shadowed wilds. It coaxes me to the vapor and the dusk.
I depart as air. I shake my white locks at the runaway sun. I effuse my flesh in eddies and drift it in lacy jags.
I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. If you want me again, look for me under your boot soles.
You will hardly know who I am or what I mean, but I shall be good health to you nevertheless, and filter and fiber your blood.
Failing to fetch me at first, keep encouraged. Missing me one place, search another. I stop somewhere, waiting for you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.